Welcome back to the Series 7 Study Guide. This is Franz. Today I've got a little bit of a different lesson for you. In fact, it's not a lesson you need to even pay any attention to at all. This is a lesson on angel investing. Now, you are not going to be covering anything about angel investing on the Series 7 examination. But there's a lot of curiosity out there in the investment community about what angel investing is, how to go about it, where do the deals come from, what are the opportunities, and it's something you probably should have at least a little bit of knowledge about. So, I belong to an angel group here in Salt Lake. It's called SLC Angels. I've belonged to this angel group for about 3 years now, and I have not made many investments. I'm pretty slow on pulling the trigger, and quite honestly, I did not understand this investment class at all when I joined, and I've been observing, watching, and learning from what I consider experts for a lot of that time. And I've now made a few investments, startup companies. I have not seen any return on them. I don't know when I will. This is longer-term investing and quite risky investing. So today I have an expert in angel investing joining me. And this is the first of two episodes. And I'll release the next one next week so you can plan on that. In fact, I'm going to schedule it out this week to be released next Friday. So I've got Phil Grimm, who's the executive director of SLC Angels, as a guest. I also consider Phil a friend, so it's nice to talk to him and have a discussion with him. And I'm looking forward to interviewing a couple more people in the group as well. Rob Coons, who runs an accelerator incubator group called Boom Startup here in Salt Lake. I'm trying to get him to come on and talk about incubators and accelerator programs and how this differs or how this works together with angel investing. After you've listened to this, you may have a bit of interest in angel investing, but understand that to join the group, you need to be considered an accredited investor. If you're in Salt Lake, you may not qualify as an accredited investor, but if you know of people who are and are in Salt Lake or Northern Utah that are interested in possibly joining my group, I'd like to introduce them to the group, take them to a couple of meetings, let them see what it's like, and see if there's any interest in them joining the group with no obligation, of course. So get a hold of me if you know of anybody in Northern Utah that might be interested, or have them get a hold of me. Just use the contact form at the website to do that. And if you have any comments, again, use the contact form at the website. I don't know if you took any psychology courses in high school or college, but there's this theory called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. And in Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs, he talks about the lowest need was a psychological need, then the need for safety, then the need for love and belonging, then the need for esteem from colleagues. And at the top of the pyramid, when you've achieved everything else, there's the tip of the pyramid called the self-actualization portion of the Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. When I started this podcast, it was with the intention of helping people pass the Series 7 examination. And every now and then I get a letter which puts me right at the very top of this pyramid, the self-actualization section, because letters like this really make me feel good for having contributed something. So I'm going to read this quick letter. It's from a lady named Beth. And it was just a quick letter. She said, "I just wanted to thank you for your podcasts. I purchased them all to enhance my preparation. I was recently successful in passing the Series 7. I work full-time and have 2 children and can't imagine passing without your podcasts. They were very comprehensive and well-organized. Thanks again." It wasn't much on Beth's part, but it meant a lot to me. And thanks, Beth. I really appreciate you letting me know that. I really appreciate you letting me know that my lessons helped you pass the Series 7. I wrote back to Beth and I said, "Beth, if you really liked him, would you write a little comment in iTunes or Amazon?" And she said she would, so I hope she does. All right, quick advertisement. If you want to study at a faster rate than the podcasts that come out, please consider buying the course. It's $59 at the website, series7podcast.com. That's over 20 hours of instructions. I think it's 23 hours of instructions. The details are there at the website. But it's not designed to replace the studies and the practice tests and the reading material that you should go through. This is designed as a way to enhance your study through an audio course. Maybe you can learn it entirely through audio. I kind of doubt it. I think you need to sit down and do some practice examinations, read books. But this hopefully will reinforce what you're reading and possibly answer some questions along the way. So if you want to study at a faster rate, at the website you can get all 54 lessons. Or if you've previously bought the bundle of 50 lessons, you can pick up the additional 4 lessons as well. Series7podcast.com. Okay, with that advertisement out of the way, let's get on to this portion of the podcast. And oh, by the way, I'm thinking of doing a podcast strictly on angel investing. And I actually ran this idea by Phil when he was at the office, because I don't think I have enough knowledge or enough contacts to do it on my own. But I ran the idea by Phil, and I was exploring the possibility of him being a co-host on the podcast. And it may be more than Phil as well. It may be 3 or 4 co-hosts on the podcast. But I'm thinking that this may be the first episode of that podcast if I choose to go down that path. And it would be a separate podcast that dealt just with angel investing and possibly a little bit of venture capital as well, but mostly angel investing. So if you think that sounds like a good idea, drop me a note. All right, let's get on to this interview about angel investing. So I'm here with Phil Grimm. Phil is a friend of mine, and he's also a member of the angel investing group that I belong to. And he has a lot more experience than I do, so I wanted to get him in and talk to us about angel investing. Phil, tell us a little bit about your background. I know it's fascinating.
Well, I don't know if I call it fascinating. It's definitely diversified, I think, is probably the best explanation. So my traditional educational background starts with a standard collegiate education with a finance and economic and accounting background, and that's where I started my career. And my career began in what I call large corporate America. And through that trend of large corporate America and on in through publicly traded companies at rising responsibility and managerial levels, I had the opportunity to get very involved in the mergers and acquisition community at the corporate level. So I was out being involved in acquiring different technologies or entities that were then merged into the companies I was working for. I was involved in restructuring for financial purposes when one of the companies I worked for, Bomar Instrument Corporation, had some very unique technologies that they had not managed to move through the corporate arena the way they should have, and so they found themselves in financial challenges and had to restructure. So I was involved in quite frequently on the M&A side in terms of bringing technologies in and incorporating them in, or restructuring the business to be more economically sound in terms of moving the company forward. So my business background stems from originally in the large corporate arena working for entities like Motorola, publicly traded entities like Bomar Instrument Corporation. But through that, through my experience in the M&A, I decided in 1995 that I wanted to do this more on my own. I could see the benefits and all the work that was going in, but as an employee, you are being compensated and rewarded in an employment-based structure. So in 95, I broke off and I did my own mergers and acquisitions firm from 95 till our last divestiture was in 2008. And then I went back to the corporate arena for a while to do some turnarounds and then took some time off after a 25-plus year career of extensive travel and many long days.
So I know you're involved in some entrepreneurial activities right now, and we'll talk about that a little later. And you've covered some of your entrepreneurial activities in the past. What sort of a mergers and acquisition group did you start, and what type of deals did you do?
So it was really interesting, and I had an individual that I'd met in the 80s, and so that puts me at being an old guy here. But in the 80s, I met a gentleman who was involved in public accounting and was very involved with a lot of the activities that I was doing in the M&A community. He was a public accountant working for a CPA firm, one of the large at the time was the Big 8. I think it's down to maybe Big 5, Big 4 today. I don't know how many are left, but not near what there was back then. And we had similar interest. And so in the early 90s, we began looking at opportunities. And at that point in time, we were located in very different geographic regions. He was in the Midwest. I was in the Western states. And so we decided in the we worked on some transactional activity and never were able to really put something together. But some of the early days, we were involved in things in the golf industry. We both had a passion for golf, and we looked at we had met the president of the U.S. Golf Association, and we looked at we actually put together a bid to manage a golf tournament, one of the PGA tournaments. And unfortunately, our contact in that space passed away, and we lost that contact. And in business, when you're doing early stage activities, quite frequently it's about the connections you make, not just the capabilities you have. And so so we finally determined in 94 that we would both relocate back to Phoenix and work collectively to move that forward. So in 1995, we made our first acquisition. It was a small security family-owned business called U.S. Currency Protection that did security products that were used to apprehend criminals in the bank robbery industry. And we leveraged that into focusing on activities in that space. So it was very security developed early on. And then we began to broaden our reach and looked into other industries that were interesting to us. And obviously one of those was to go back into the golf industry and put together a distribution company to distribute an emerging line from Reebok into the golf industry. We leveraged that. Some of the technology bases that we were doing, we took those technologies and leveraged them into additional industries. So it was a typical entrepreneurial, do it on your own, wear many hats, grow the companies, and then find strategics or disruptive opportunities to leverage those out, and had some nice exits in the mid-2000s, and then in 2008 was kind of our last big hurrah in terms of our disposition activities. And I kept one of our portfolio companies, which was in the aviation simulation arena, only because as a pilot I have a love for that area and it allows me to still play.
Phil, I met you when I joined SLC Angels. You've been active in SLC Angels for quite a while. Tell us how the group started and how you're involved with SLC Angels.
Well, actually, when I got involved with what is now SLC Angels, it was Olympus Angels. And it is I'll call it a typical angel group. I mean, an angel group is a group of individuals that have a common interest in supporting the entrepreneurial community and the local economy and look to make those investments that are necessary to shore up the capital balances for those young startup companies that don't have access to loans and things like that that are more traditional to well-established companies that have good sound bottom lines. My early involvement started through a group called the Wayne Brown Institute, which is it's hard to describe precisely what they do. They're not an accelerator. They really are an educational purpose to teach young companies how to improve their pitch and where to look for capital and basically get an early stage startup entrepreneur a roadmap to move forward. And through the founder of that, or I shouldn't say the founder, but one of the early participants, it's a 30-year-old organization, I was introduced to the Olympus Angels. I had exited from a number of transactions and believe in giving back to that rewarded you. And so I was introduced to the Olympus Angels, and then it moved forward and the name was changed to the SLC Angels, and I was asked to be their executive director a couple of years ago.
How would you define angel investing and compare that to regular equity investing?
Well, they have a number of similarities, but they have a number of differences. Let's start with the risk factor. Angel investing obviously is a high-risk environment. You don't have a lot of trends to work off. You're typically looking at a conceptual plan, a group of individuals that have an idea or a concept that they believe have a market opportunity and potential. So when you're looking at traditional equity investing, you're typically more focused on evaluating the trends in an ongoing business that may have 100 years of history, 100 years of legacy. It may be something new that seems to have a lot of traction, but it's going to be typically traded in a public market. It might be a pink sheet market, but it might be traded on one of the large exchanges. when you're dealing with angel investing, you're really looking at stuff that's quite frequently conceptual. It's often before a product may be ready or before the software or any real structure behind it. So really what you're doing is you're looking at a vision, if you will, someone's vision and their roadmap. And because of that, there's considerably higher risk. But also typically with higher risk, when you're investing very early, the opportunity for high reward presents itself because now you're getting in very, very early with limited dollars into something that can grow. So if you take, you know, and I don't know the exact numbers, but every company on the exchange started as an entrepreneurial company. So look at the big names that people are most familiar with, like an Apple. I'll just use Apple as a great example. It started as an entrepreneurial company. Somebody, as an angel investor, decided they were going to put money into Steve Jobs and Apple and his team. And of course, you know, it's one of the most highest valued publicly traded companies today.
So you've been angel investing for what, about 10 years now?
Well, technically, I guess you could say I've been angel investing since 1995, but quite frequently it was in myself early on. So as an entrepreneur who goes out and puts his own acquisition company together to acquire some businesses and move them forward and grow them, that's a form of angel investing. So technically, I guess I could say I've been in angel investing since 95, but as someone who is a non-participating member and just putting funds into companies, it's probably been, close to 10 years now.
Do you invest with SLC Angels generally, or do you invest individually outside the group as well?
So I do both. And actually, the way angel investment groups tend to work, but it's changing. It's going to change a little bit. So I'm going to talk about historically what happens. Historically, it's a group of individuals. They have diversified talents from diversified backgrounds and diversified industries. And so companies will come through and present what they're doing, and that group of individuals will find out who the interested parties are and then try and move forward from there. But as an individual, I've invested individually, collectively with others, and then in what we call more fund-related strategies.
So what parameters do you personally use when you're investing? I know you've invested in golf-type businesses in the past. Do you limit yourself geographically, by industry? How do you choose the investments that you make?
Well, I think that we all want to believe we invest in what we believe will make money. So, you know, I in some of the activities, I still get involved in public presentations, and I jokingly say that every investor technically is a greedy bastard. And so obviously, and that's not really true. We're really there to move the business world and the community forward. But in reality, I think we all look for transactions that we believe are going to make a sound and solid return. Now, in doing that, in saying that, you either have to rely on your skill set to evaluate the likelihood of success of not just the technology in the company, but the team and all the various parameters, because now you're working with quite frequently an entity that you don't have a lot of knowledge about. So you either find confidence in those around you that you believe can conduct that level of investigation called due diligence, or you focus on something that you have the experience where you believe that you have the necessary tools to evaluate the likelihood of business success.
So let's talk about the due diligence process. How involved do you get when you're doing your due diligence?
Well, it depends on the deal. It depends on the team. It depends on a lot of the parameters. If it's really, really early stage, the due diligence may focus on forward trends, which is quite different than due diligence related to a larger equity transaction on a merger and acquisition. Because a merger and acquisition, you're not only looking at historical trends, but you're also looking at forward trends. But when you're focused on an early stage entrepreneurial type investment, there's not a lot of historical or legacy data. So you might look at things like the team. I mean, you know, who are the members of the team? What are they young? Are they old? Are they experienced? Have they had their ups and downs? I think every entrepreneur has an up and down period. Not everything's always going to be successful. We can look at, again, a guy like a Steve Jobs. I mean, he went from very success to a disaster to back to success. So you're trying to look at the people who are going to be behind it. You're trying to look at trying to collect some market data in terms of why people would be interested. What information do they have that would suggest that there's going to be a revenue opportunity behind what you're doing? So the due diligence is very different. It's hard to suggest exactly what that due diligence process is because it's different in every transaction. Some may be more technically oriented. We may be looking behind what's there.
Let's talk about the one you and I did together. That was my first opportunity to look at due diligence. This is a company that made a product that would actually print on rose petals. And we looked at it as a group. And just go through that process with us.
That one was a little different because that one was probably further along than a lot of the companies we see, but I think it's a great example. This was a small company that, as you said, they had the capability to print on roses, and they had the capability to not just print lettering but images, and it was really geared around kind of a marketing or special occasion type scenario. And what made that company unique, I think they had probably been in business – I don't know, more than a half a dozen years, I think, when we looked at them, if I recall correctly. And what really made them unique is we had some trend data to work with. So we were able to see what had happened. What further made that one unique that sticks out in my mind was the fact that they had also had, through their investment early on in their company foundation, they had had some major disruption in what I call the team. They had had the original founder was still there, but there was through the investment, there was a reformation. So there were a lot of elements there that made that one very unique and very different because we could see the trends in terms of the revenue transaction. We could see market opportunity. We could kind of do some forecasting. We could look and say, okay, where could this thing really get to? We could look at their established relationships. There were a lot of things there that typically are not there. But there were also what I call a lot of red flag items that we saw. And typically when you have disruption in the founders team or you have early stage investors where deals go south and you see investors maybe pushed to the curb, I mean that one had all the elements that made it probably more unique than most in terms of the due diligence. So our goal was really to kind of – and it's peel the wrapper, peel the skin off the onion and start peeling down to the core and see what's really there. And the typical process for that was, Franz, I think we probably had three or four meetings collectively with them, with myself and you and another individual. And then I had an additional probably 10 to 12 follow-up meetings beyond that to see if we could peel in just a little deeper. And that one, nobody made an investment and we just couldn't get to the comfort level that we needed to, and it probably wasn't market-driven in that one. That one was probably more operationally driven.
We were comfortable with the technology. We liked the product. We liked what the company did, but we just didn't feel, as I recall, that the CEO was coachable.
I think that's a great the CEO, I think, that's a point you bring up that I think is really critical. The CEO was not what I call overly coachable, and in fact, the direction the CEO was taking we felt was probably counterproductive to the overall outcome of the business. They had a process that was working and working very well, and it was profitable. And what they wanted to do was begin to collect more margin internally by bringing more of those processes internally. And they wanted to invest large sums of dollars to do that. The problem was it was probably premature. It was a little early in the process. And through those discussions, we deemed, and you recall very well, we deemed that the CEO probably wasn't very coachable. And that becomes very important. Not that we believe that as investors we know more than the founders or the CEO. It's that management teams and CEOs, they get stuck what I call in the trees. And they get stuck in their rapport of doing something over and over, and they see the direction they want to go, and they move in that direction. Well, everybody has somebody to oversee them. At a large corporate level, you have a board of directors who oversees the managerial team, and their goal is to look at the strategic vision and then let the team implement the tactical strategy to make that happen. It's the same thing in the entrepreneurial community. That's the concept behind the angel investing in terms of getting involved and better understanding and looking. And so if we're doing that process and we see that the team or the CEO or critical members aren't really amenable to having those levels of discussions and maybe looking at things differently, it's probably not something that we look to invest in.
So you had quite a history of investing in startups. What is usually the time frame you look at when making an investment in a startup as an angel investor?
Well, that's an interesting question because it can be really, really early on. I think some of them are just what I call back of napkin concepts. Everybody who starts a business needs money, and normally you turn to your own coffers or friends and family early on before you go outside to angel investing. So I would say that typically my experience investing is as early as theoretical concept clear to post-revenue. And when we're talking post-revenue, we're probably talking post-revenue that's, you know, no more than a few million dollars a year. At that point in time, there's additional avenues for an entrepreneur to go find capital, and maybe the angel community is not the best community at that point. But yeah, pretty early to post-revenue.
So what's been the longest you've held where you've had a successful exit? And have you written very many of your investments off entirely?
Fortunately, I haven't written any investments off yet. I have one investment that that we did that we didn't write it off, but we didn't get a traditional angel-type return. We got a factor of interest. So the shortest transaction, I think, is 2 years. And the longest transaction, well, I think I've got one that's now about 4 or 5 years into the transaction. And you know, and as long as they're moving forward, I think people think that angel investing is a way to get in and get out really quick. It's actually the opposite. Angel investments tend to have a life cycle of it depends on the industry, but I think as low as 3 years to as many as 8 to 10 years. It just really depends on where they get to and when they become a target that creates liquidity for the early stage investors.
So you alluded to the one company that you got a factor of interest off of. And I remember when that occurred, and a lot of the investors were pretty upset over that outcome. Do you want to go into any detail on that?
Well, I mean, we can talk briefly about it. I mean, people were upset about the outcome, only not necessarily because of the outcome, because at the end of the day, everybody got their money back in a modest rate of interest, better than what I would call market interest on a very conservative investment. But, you know, you invest with the desire to help grow a company. You invest to get a return. You invest to accomplish a lot of objectives and goals. And they all are measured differently. Sometimes they're, you know, some of those goals are measured on value and time value of money. Sometimes it's because you want to see the company grow. And what caused people probably to be more upset on this one was the way in which the exit happened, where it was clear that the founding team found a methodology to work around the investors to get them paid back and not have to give up the appropriate equity position in that investment. So it was a little bit slimy of the founding team. I think there were some probably good indications that could have happened, not necessarily during the due diligence period, but early on in the investment. And, you know, unfortunately, you can't stop people from what I call being a little less than honest. But at the end of the day, people got their money back in a return, so that always eases that pain of not having gotten the return that everybody anticipated.
So let's talk about deal structure. And there seems to be a lot of different routes that are taken to achieve funding of a startup. Some people talk about preferred stock, notes, caps on notes, caps on preferred stocks. Give us a little education on deal structure and terminology.
Okay, well, that's a pretty broad question. So let's try and simplify it. So first of all, keep in mind that when you're investing in a early stage, there's very little asset-related value. So it's really, really hard at the time to predict what the true value of that investment is. So quite frequently, let's start with what I call the basic methodology of investing into an angel-type scenario. Quite frequently, somebody's going to believe that it's too early to create a value, but they need cash, so you invest in what's called a convertible note. I guess the more technical term in the finance world would be a convertible debenture. It's the same type of thing. But basically, you're suggesting that you're going to make an investment, and over the next typically couple years, the company's going to have an opportunity to begin to situate themselves where they will be able to get some form of a third-party valuation. And at that point in time, then that note's going to convert. For that, since you're kind of got a deferred time frame behind that, you technically take a discount. So let's hypothetically say you invest $100, which is way too small for an angel deal, but let's just hypothetically for simple math, say it's $100. So typically, a typical convertible note is going to have a 24 to 36 month term on that $100. It's going to come with a discount at the point of conversion. Typically, that's going to be roughly anywhere between 15 to 30%, depending upon the transaction. That 15 to 30% then, when that $100, if somebody else puts $100 in, you're going to get, and we'd have to do backwards math, but roughly $130 worth of value compared to their $100. You're also going to accrue an interest value in case they can't get investment and they need to pay that money back, or there's a liquidation and there's some form of payback. You're going to get some form of an interest value. That interest value in today's market runs in the 6 to 10%. Range. It's a factor of certain levels of risk. The other element to that, it's going to have a cap rate. So since nobody can really predict, what you're hoping for is the company skyrockets. Uber is a great example of a company that skyrocketed very quickly. So what you're going to do is set where your investment caps in terms of their valuation. So let's hypothetically say we invest in day one and it's a 3-year convertible, and in 3 years that company's worth $100 million. And today you can't even predict a value. Well, you want that upside potential. So normally what we're going to do is set a cap. So the average, what we see here in Utah, a little different from the coast, the average that we see in Utah, we see cap rates in the $2 to $5 million range. With the 3-year conversion. So if they raise in 3 years at a much higher value, we get our value at that $5 million or $2 to $5 million or whatever that cap rate is. So we get an immediate bump in value on our investment. That's what you're hoping for. Doesn't give you an opportunity for liquidity yet. It's pre-exit. It's just a paper gain in reality. It's nothing more than a paper gain because there's no real – well, there are some secondary markets, but there's not – what I call a broad base of secondary markets to move that investment to another party like there is in the exchange. So that's one example.
Let me clarify that because I want to make sure I understand it for myself. So let's say, for example, we invest, let's say, $1,000 to keep the numbers simple, into a company with a cap rate of – what would a cap rate be? 2 times, 3 times, 4 times?
That. Well, it's not based on – it's not necessarily based – so let's hypothetically – let's simplify it even more. Let's hypothetically say that they're raising $100,000. And so, you know, we're going to find 10 individuals all to bring $10,000 in. And at that point in time, we can't tell what that company is really worth, or we'd put a value on it and maybe just do stock, which we'll get to in a minute. But – so let's hypothetically say that we look at the group and we say, okay, 3 years from now, we want you to have a fixed value on your company at no greater than $3 million. No greater than. Now, if they raise in 3 years additional money, and in a convertible also, if they raise prior to 3 years, then it may convert. I mean, there's a lot of terms, but let's keep it this simple. Let's hypothetically say that's enough money, they don't raise for three more years. And in 3 years, they built that company to the point where it's worth $10 million. So they're going to now go raise additional money at a $10 million valuation. But we created a cap of $3 million. These are just examples. They're not fixed numbers. But we created a cap of $3 million. So when we convert that note to equity, we convert our $100,000 at a $3 million, and we'll call it pre-money or post-money, maybe post-money to make it simple. So our shares of stock are the percentage of our $100,000 against $3 million. Now, there's downside risk. Let's hypothetically say in 3 years they haven't done a very good job and they have to go raise more money, and they raise it at a $2 million valuation. Well, at that point, our investment would then convert at a $2 million transactional valuation. So our equity position in that situation would be worth considerably less than if they did a great job and did it on the upside.
So if they had sold it, let's say they raised money at $10 million, we're getting a better buy because we're buying it at a $3 million valuation.
That's correct. Example.
Okay. All right, so continue on with it, whatever you were going
so
with.
The next form of investment that, again, keeping in mind that it's really hard to set a valuation very early on, some people may come out and believe that they can set a valuation, and they may then want to give you stock. And just like in the equity markets, there's two forms of stock. There's common and there's preferred. And there's some other subclasses to those, but we'll keep it simple at common and preferred. The normal investment in stock in an early structured deal, an angel investing deal, is preferred. And the reason is again, like, and the reason you do a convertible note is if the worst thing happens and you have to liquidate, you want to make sure that you have access to any value early on, that you get your money first. It may only be 10 cents on the dollar, but it's 10 cents on the dollar. You don't want the founder who screwed it up to get all the money and you get nothing for handing them money. So the stock investment, obviously you have to fix a valuation. And at that point in time, let's go back to hypothetically and say that the company is valued at $3 million at the time and you invest $100,000. Well, you invest that $100,000 in what's typically called a participating preferred stock. And that allows you to have first distribution rights in the event of liquidation. Now, behind that, there's probably going to be a trigger at some future date that will roll that to common stock. Once that risk is at a more minimal environment than what it is when you invest.
All right. In the next episode, we start down the path of more detail, and we start out with the question on what pre-money valuation is and some of the terminology and some of the documents that are used in preparing deals for angel investing. So stay tuned for that. That'll be released in about a week. So my quick advertisement, if you think you would like to study at a faster rate for the Series 7 examination, please go to my website, series7podcast.com, and look for the audio study products, and you can buy the full bundle of 50 at $59.99. That's about 23 hours of audio instruction. It's not designed to replace the study of books or the practice examination. It's only designed to help you in your studies, not to be a replacement for the other type of studying you should be doing. Right, if you have any comments, thoughts, questions, or if you have somebody that might be interested in joining SLC Angels, have them get a hold of me and use the contact form at the website, series7podcast.com. Thanks. Keep studying.